From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Hans Blix, former director of the UN commission that conducted weapons inspections in Iraq. We'll talk with him about the inspections process, his views on the Bush administration's decision to invade Iraq, and the threats from weapons of mass destruction that we face today. Blix has written a new memoir called Disarming Iraq. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the use of profanity on TV, and rock historian Ed Ward remembers Dimension Records, which showcased the talents of Jerry Goffin, Carole King, Little Eva, and others. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House Ethics Committee says it will look into charges that GOP Representative Nick Smith was offered a bribe if he'd vote for the Medicare bill. NPR's Andrea Seabrook explains.
The Ethics Committee has announced that it will formally appoint a panel of members to investigate allegations that a member of Congress was told that his son's political campaign would receive financial support if this member changed his vote in support of the legislation. During the Medicare vote, the Republican leadership held open the vote for almost 3 hours in the House of Representatives, trying to get one or two Republicans to switch their votes in favor of their own Republican-sponsored bill.
NPR's Andrea Seabrook. A massive car bombing has killed at least 27 people and injured dozens more in Baghdad. NPR's Steve Inskeep was at the scene. He says it appears that the Mount Lebanon Hotel was the target, but a nearby building was hit hardest.
Some of the worst destruction came when the explosion destroyed a 5-story apartment building, which was next to the Mount Lebanon Hotel. That building appears to have completely collapsed in on itself. There are some other houses as well that were destroyed. We've heard stories from witnesses who were nearby, just outside that apartment building, and rushed in trying to save their families, trying to pull them out of the wreckage. In some cases, they were successful. In other cases, not.
NPR Steve Inskeep in Baghdad. Spanish officials have announced new plans to increase national security following last week's bombings on a commuter rail line that left more than 200 people dead. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Madrid.
Security today was stepped up at airports, at strategic installations throughout Spain, and also the Prime Minister-elect, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, announced a whole security shakeup. He's going to, when his government is sworn in, he says he's going to make some big changes at the top level of the police and security forces. And he also said, you know, he was very tough on terrorism. He said we're going to fight any armed group, including the any violent group, including the Basque terrorist ETA.
NPR Silvia Poggioli in Madrid. Police in Las Vegas, Nevada, have arrested a suspect in a series of sniper shootings in and around Columbus, Ohio. Acting on a tip from a Las Vegas resident, police arrested Charles McCoy Jr. without incident at a motel. Officials in Ohio identified the 28-year-old McCoy as a suspect in 24 shootings, most of them at vehicles on a stretch of highway in Columbus. The shootings include the murder of a 62-year-old woman who was a passenger in a car that was hit. In stocks, the Dow gained 115 points to close at 10,300. The Nasdaq was up 33 to close at 1976. This is NPR News. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency said today that Iran is once again cooperating with international nuclear inspectors. Mohammad El-Baradei told President Bush that Iran says it will allow inspectors to start their work again on March 27th. Iran suspended the inspections last week after international officials accused Iran of failing to disclose all the promised information about its nuclear program. Officials in Savannah, Georgia, say 8 people were injured after a car in the city's St. Patrick's Day parade drove out of control. Orlando Montoya reports from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Savannah.
Police say a gold convertible with green shamrocks taped on its sides was attempting to pass a group of marchers in the parade when it suddenly accelerated through an intersection and into one of Savannah's park squares, where people had gathered to watch the procession. The injured included three members of a New Jersey marching band and several parade watchers. Witnesses said several people were dragged underneath the car and described people screaming for the car to stop before it came to rest. The accident happened about midway through what's billed as the nation's second-largest St. Patrick's Day parade after New York's. About 300,000 visitors were said to have lined city streets and squares to watch the event. Hospital officials said most of the injured were expected to be treated and released. For NPR News, I'm Orlando Montoya in Savannah, Georgia.
Fighting broke out today between Serbs and ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. NATO peacekeepers said 8 people were killed and more than 300 injured by gunfire and grenades in the divided city of Mitrovica. The fighting was reportedly triggered by the deaths of 2 Albanian boys who allegedly drowned while trying to escape an attack by Serbs. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of natural vitamin E, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Hans Blix was the head of the UN weapons inspection team in Iraq, which was officially called the UN Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission, or UNMOVIC. It was established by a Security Council resolution in December 1999 to investigate whether there were still weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. In November 2002, a new round of inspections was initiated. 3.5 months later, Blix and his team were called back by the UN as the U.S. gave up on the inspection process and prepared to invade Iraq. In his new memoir, Disarming Iraq, Blix describes what happened behind the scenes during his search for weapons of mass destruction. He spent 18 years as the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, and 20 years as a member of Sweden's delegation to the UN. Blix is now the head of the new International Commission on Weapons of Mass Destruction. What was your alternate scenario in Iraq? If weapons inspections had been given more of a chance, what do you think the outcome might have been?
Well, there are two things that we would have wanted to do. The first would have been to carry on with the inspections of sites, and notably those sites that have been given to us by intelligence as promising. And I think that if we had been to all these, and of course they would have shown that there were no weapons of mass destruction, then the intelligence which had given us the sites might have begun to doubt themselves that there was anything. The second avenue was on interviews. We had some difficulties in getting the right format for the interviews, of not having any mind or official person present, because that would intimidate the witnesses, or to have any tape recorder. But gradually the Iraqis gave way on that. And towards the end, we were given long lists of people whom they said had participated in the destruction of biological and chemical weapons in 1991, when they said it had all been destroyed. And they had not had any inspectors present during the destruction. And that's why we doubted, and UNSCOM, our predecessors, also doubted that they had destroyed all and that they perhaps had squirreled away something. Now we wanted documentation about this destruction, and they said they had none, they had been destroyed. And we said, then, couldn't you have witnesses? And that was why they gave us this long list of witnesses. And we would have gone ahead and interviewed them.
If you find weapons of mass destruction, you have definitive evidence that there are weapons. If you don't find definitive evidence, then it's perhaps less than definitive that there are no weapons of mass destruction, because they still might be hidden someplace. They might have been temporarily shipped out of the country, waiting to be shipped back in after the inspections process is over. Would there have been a point where you could have said to yourself, definitive, there's nothing here?
Well, you know, it's always very hard to prove the negative. If I sit in this room, or studio, can I swear that there is not a safety pin hidden somewhere in this room? So it is hard. And the Iraqis often said that to us. How can we prove there is nothing in this vast country? That's what you want. And I said, yes, that is true, but you can at least help to make it plausible. And in fact, the world needs to feel assured that there is nothing, and they want to hear us say that. And it is more difficult for us than it is for you, because you have all the budgets, you have all the reports, you have all the archives, you have all the witnesses. So you better make that effort. You will not completely succeed, but you can make it plausible. And they try to do that towards the end.
If you had completed the weapons inspection process and you determined that there were no weapons of mass destruction, and if the United States and its allies did not invade Iraq, then Saddam Hussein would have still been in power. Looking at that alternate scenario and looking at the way the war did work out, do you have a sense in your own mind about which the preferable scenario is?
Yes. I think you're right in saying that it's likely that Saddam would have remained in power. And this was one of the bloodiest terror regimes the world has seen in this century, so that would certainly have been something negative. And I think it's the one gain I can see at the present time from the invasion, that the regime is gone and we all hope for democracy to come. However, when it comes to the question, was the armed intervention justified? You can look upon that from different points of view. You can look upon it from the legal standpoint. Was this in conformity with the UN Charter and resolutions? That's one aspect. I don't think they have really devoted so much time to that question. The other is, was it justified from a political point of view? And there, the main argument advanced was that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And I don't think that was justified. I mean, if you fought the war for to take out weapons of mass destruction, clearly it was not justified since they were not there. And I don't... If they had said that we'll fight the war because the uncertainty about the weapons is unbearable, well, then we would have achieved the certainty through the war. But that was not what they said. Colin Powell said that there are real weapons, there are real anthrax, real VX, etc. And that was founded upon very, very shaky evidence, even erroneous, of course.
You think the evidence was shaky? Do you think that the Bush administration knew that it was shaky and intentionally used whatever evidence it could get to make its case? In other words, used evidence selectively? Or do you believe that the United States was acting, you know, the Bush administration was acting after honestly assessing the intelligence information it had?
Well, I have never suggested that either Bush or Blair was in bad faith in what they said. I don't think so. But, you know, in some laws, it says that you are not allowed to do something wittingly, or if you shouldn't have known that there certain circumstances existed. And I think that if they had exercised more of a critical thinking, they would also at the higher political levels have seen that the evidence was shaky.
Now, you write in your book, Disarming Iraq, that you believed that Iraq was hiding weapons of mass destruction. Is there a point in which you changed your mind?
Yes.
What was that point?
First of all, you see, when I took on the job and when I was there, when we were there with the inspectors in November and December 2002, I was asked sometimes, do you think, what is your gut feeling about the weapons of mass destruction? And my answer then was, look, I'm engaged as an inspector of the Security Council and not to give gut feelings, but rather to inspect and to report. That's what I do. So I wouldn't have answered it in December. But now we are over a year later. And then I can tell you that, yes, in December, like most people, I looked at the behavior of the Iraqis in the 90s, and I thought it was also very likely that they had weapons of mass destruction. Even in beginning of January, I was of this view. And when we found some 12 warheads, which were meant for chemical weapons, they were empty, but we found 12 warheads. I asked myself, and I said to the Security Council, this might be the tip of an iceberg, or it might be broken up pieces of an ice that was once there. So I kept, in January, kept the possibilities open. However, it was in January that we also began to go to sites given by intelligence, which they believed had weapons of mass destruction. It turned out to be wrong. We went to many of them, and only on 3 sites did we find anything at all of interest. We found a stash of documents that related to nuclear matter. We found some an ammunition of conventional kind in a farm, and we found a lot of illegally imported Volga rocket engines, but no weapons of mass destruction. So I began to feel that the intelligence doesn't really know. They were 100% convinced that there were weapons, and they had 0% knowledge, it appeared, of where they were. And so we said that. We told them if we had received tips by them where to go, then we would tell them that we didn't find anything. And I also said to Condoleezza Rice that I will have to say something about this in the Security Council. That was after Colin Powell's presentation, because we had some doubts about some of the cases he advanced.
Well, another question, and you ask this in the book, is if Iraq, in fact, had no weapons of mass destruction, why was it behaving as if it had something to hide?
Yes, that is, I think, an important question, and maybe we only get a real answer to it when we have talked to more Iraqis and at great length. I would like myself to have a talk with Amir al-Sadi, who was my opposite number, about it. And I've seen some glimpses of answers in interviews by many excellent investigating journalists who have been there, from the U.S. in particular. And there was one who was a prominent man in the chemical field who was asked, why did they behave as he did? And he said, why did Saddam behave? And he said that, well, I don't know, maybe it was pride. That was his answer. I have some other speculations, and one of the most important is that often the U.S. would say that sanctions will not be lifted until Saddam is gone, whereas the UN Security Council said, Saddam, the sanctions will be lifted if you have declared and destroyed all the weapons, and the inspectors verify that that is the case. But when the U.S. said that sanctions will not be lifted unless Saddam disappears, of course, that would not give him any incentive to cooperate. He could perhaps just as well play cat and mouse with the inspector. That's one possibility. Another is that he, although they said they had no weapons, maybe they didn't mind the suspicion being there that they had weapons, because it made them a little more dangerous. And, of course, the U.S., when it went in here in 2003, the soldiers were donning chemical protection suits again and again. So that seemed to work, and the whole world believed that they had the weapons, including their neighbors and their own population. That's one further. Then you could also think and be aware that the Iraqis knew that the inspection teams also worked for intelligence, that they they knew that they were piggybacking, but they assumed at any rate that everything the inspectors saw went directly to the agencies, and that they thereby also were given the possibility of finding targets for bombing, which occurred in connection with the upholding of the no-fly zones. And you can imagine that there was not any great enthusiasm for helping the inspector to see something if they felt that they were just giving better targets for an enemy.
You write in your book that as the chief inspector, you didn't want the inspector's tone to be provocative. You wanted the tone to be neutral. You say inspectors aren't occupiers. Inspectors should avoid humiliating the inspection. Why is that important?
Well, if you are an occupying army, then you are by definition humiliating, and you bully the country within the laws of war. But if you are inspectors, then you are more closer to observers, and you do require their cooperation in order to get somewhere. They are, of course, bound by rules of the Security Council, accepting snap inspections, and they are bound to allow you to interview people, go anywhere, anytime. But you need a measure of cooperation with them. And the experience I had from inspections in the 90s, what I'd heard from many inspectors on the sites who had been there, was that they usually got more information out of the Iraqi engineers and the military if they treated them with some civility. I'm not saying that you should be cozy, absolutely not, but nevertheless some civility in about the same manner as we would like our police in our national societies to treat people whom they arrest. They are not to be humiliated. We know that they may have committed crimes, and we must be firm with them. We must use our rights, but not humiliation. And I think there were in the past elements of that bullying, especially if you come with white people from Northern Hemisphere, Western world, a country that had a colonialist past. You must be very careful about the dignity of it, and that's true even today.
My guest is Hans Blix, the former UN chief weapons inspector in Iraq. His new memoir is called Disarming Iraq. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Hans Blix is my guest, and he was the head of UNMOVIC, the UN Weapons Inspection Team in Iraq, and he has written a new book called Disarming Iraq. The U.S. military buildup in Iraq helped push Iraq to open itself up to your weapons inspections. At the same time, I think you feel that that buildup made war just about inevitable. So looking back, how do you feel about that military buildup and its kind of strengths and weaknesses in helping you do your job?
Yes, I'm not a pacifist, nor is the UN Charter a pacifist instrument. On the contrary, the Charter foresees the possibility of authorizing the use of force and diplomatic pressure, economic pressure, military pressure. And I think that the U.S. buildup that began in the summer of 2002 was welcome. The Iraqis had been sort of playing diplomatic cat and mouse with me and with Kofi Annan, and we didn't get anywhere in our pressures to get inspections. But when the build-up began, well, then they changed course and they accepted inspections then in September of 2002. Now, then the build-up continued. It was as if you had put a military train on a track and they loaded more and more people on it, more and more weapon, it moved forward. Now that I saw as a pressure. I think Condoleezza Rice also saw it as a pressure that maybe the Iraqis at some point would crack, that they would sort of come forward and say, well, look here, we have tried to fool you, but here are the weapons and here's the documentation. But they didn't, because they didn't have the weapons. Maybe they didn't have the documentation either. So the build-up continued, and when in February they were up to about 200,000 men, well, it would have required, I think at that point, a very spectacular something to get the U.S. administration to call it off. They could have, and I never thought that it was decided and final until they start the march in. I mean, the president of the country, the commander-in-chief, he can give an order at any moment. So looked at it in that way, I don't think it was final. But it was building up to a very difficult thing to withdraw them. And they were also looking forward then to a season that was hot, and to keep 200,000 men in the desert sitting and it's getting hot, that was not attractive. So I think the weather and the season had something to do with it.
Would you like to see any formal criticism of the U.S. in the U.N.?
I don't think it really matters, you know, if you have... There people talk about apologies and formal criticism. This only irritates and makes it more difficult to heal rifts that have existed there. I think it's clear from my reading on media, both in Europe, England, and here in the U.S., that both Blair and Bush have suffered somewhat of their credibility for this. And I guess that's the natural consequence, in a way, if you want to say the punishment for not having been sufficiently sincere and frank about it. There was too much spin.
In your book, you write that you concluded that President Bush, having declared war on terrorism, needed to eliminate the Iraqi threat before the next election. Are you saying in that statement that you think the war in Iraq was in part politically motivated?
Well, I think I put it as a speculation rather than as an assertion. But President Bush advanced the war on terrorism as a great vocation of his presidency. I think there he saw clearly a need that I think many Americans responded to of meeting the threats that had come manifested and the terror that had been manifested in the 9/11. And they must have had a plan then how to go about it. I wholeheartedly approved of the first part of this, and I thought it was anti-illegal. They turned to Afghanistan, and they said that you must extradite al-Qaeda to us. And if you do not extradite al-Qaeda, then we will take you out. We because you have hosted these people and you have allowed your territory to be a base for an attack against the United States. And I think that was an impeccable argument. And also the invasion, I think the world approved of it, and lots of support for that. But it was as if it were not enough. Well, this is my perception. I'm a European. I lived through this too. I think it, to me it seemed as if it were not enough, that they would have to go on. Terrorism was a bigger thing. And they asked themselves now, what if these people had worse things than paper cutters and the talent to fly planes? And they would also try to get hold of weapons of mass destruction. Well, they are biological, they are chemical, and they are nuclear. And they asked, they wouldn't hesitate to use this weapon against us or others. No, probably not. But where could they get them? Well, then they looked at Iraq. Iraq had them, at any rate. So that could be a place. And similarly, was there a link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq? And they tried strenuously to construct such a link. And you can see from the U.S. media that there was much, much doubted. But Saddam fitted rather well into a picture of symbolizing the evil. And there were many other reasons. We have heard speculations that if they could establish a democracy in Iraq, well, that would change the whole situation. Maybe the path to peace would be easier, etc. So there were many reasons, as Wolfowitz has said, that when they settled for the weapons of mass destruction, he called it a bureaucratic reason, rationale. Well, that was that within the big U.S. administration, this was the one reason that everybody could agree on. And in fact, the same thing applied to the world and to Congress. If they had come to Congress and said, we want to take out Saddam Hussein because he's cruel and horrible, well, we would not have got a resolution. If they simply said that we think he might be going for weapons of mass destruction and the uncertainty is unbearable, I don't think they, again, would have had support. But both President Bush and Blair in London went to their legislators and said, it's a matter of fact, they have it, it's threatening. And in Blair's case, he even said that he could have weapons of mass destruction ready for use within 45 minutes. Now, that was painting a very ominous picture of the whole thing. I think that, I would call that spin, and really leading the people to conclusions that were more far-reaching than reality justified.
Hans Blix is the former UN chief weapons inspector in Iraq. His new memoir is called Disarming Iraq. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Aveda, an earth-conscious beauty company committed to preserving natural resources and finding more sustainable ways of doing business. Information available at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we continue our interview with Hans Blix, the UN's former chief weapons inspector in Iraq. Also, our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the use of profanity on TV. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers Dimension Records, which showcased the talents of such songwriters as Jerry Goffin and Carole King. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Hans Blix, the UN's former chief weapons inspector in Iraq. He headed the UN Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission, or UNMOVIC. His inspections were terminated when the United States and its allies gave up on the inspection process and decided to invade Iraq. Blix has written a new book about his search for weapons of mass destruction called Disarming Iraq. When we left off, we were talking about his analysis of why President Bush and Prime Minister Blair decided to invade Iraq. If we proceed with the premise that you just stated, which is that weapons of mass destruction was one of many reasons, one of several reasons, that the U.S. led the invasion of Iraq, but it was the reason that everyone in the administration could kind of get behind and use as a kind of public face for the invasion, does that make you an UNMOVIC something of a pawn in that game?
Well, there were big parts of the U.S. administration that didn't like inspection a bit. And Vice President Cheney said in August 2002 that inspections are useless at best. And I'm sure that view was shared by Pentagon. Rumsfeld said on a later occasion when they were saying that Saddam would have to have a change of heart and he would have to take a strategic decision. He said, for this, you don't need more than two inspectors. So I think there was not even only criticism or critical attitude, there was even a disdain for inspection that I think was misplaced. And against me, too, personally. And there's some people who claim that Blix had always been soft, etc. However, in the Security Council, which was my boss, they were the ones I reported to, and they were their instructions that I followed. There was never at any stage a criticism of the inspections. We built them up methodically, we trained our people, we prepared the analysis of past documents, etc. And all through, until the very end, until the invasion had come, there was nothing but appreciation for professionally run inspections. And we were much more independent than UNSCOM, the previous inspection, were. They were very closely knit to the intelligence services. They were allowed themselves to be piggybacked with electronic equipment that monitored Iraq for these organizations, which was not in the UN resolution. We did not do that. We treated intelligence as in principle being a one-way traffic. They should tell us, but we should not share with them anything that could help them to establish targeting or things like that. There was some feedback, because if they give you a target, if they give you a site and you go to and you find nothing, you must tell them that there wasn't anything, because that will help them to evaluate the reliability of the source.
Is that what you mean when you say in your book that you had to protect UNMOVIC from becoming an arm of the CIA?
Yes, that's right.
What are some of the other ways that the United States tried to shape the style or the tone of the weapons inspections in Iraq?
Well, from the outset in the year 2000, when I came here, they didn't really meddle at all they were positive, helpful. They told us that they would assist us if we ran courses, etc. But they did not really say anything about how should we run the inspections. And it would have been premature, because we were not allowed to get in. But in the autumn of 2002, when we had begun or were beginning our work there, well, then they came in alone of all the members of the Security Council and said that now we will tell you how we think you should go about this. And we had been preparing ourselves for 2 years already, so we had some views of our own. And fine, I was not resenting this at all. It's fine if they want to recommend it, but we decide what we'll do. There were ideas that, for instance, that we should have a top-down approach, which meant that we should go to the ministers and we should look at the computers in the ministers, and from the computers we would probably learn where the weapons of mass destruction were. And, I listened to that, and I had some little doubts in my mind what was the purpose of this advice. It could have been genuine, but it could also have been that either they would like us to get into a situation where we provoke the Iraqis, and where they would say no, we would have a denial of access, and that could be a cause for war.
So the impression I've gotten from your book and from what you've said is that you think that the United States wanted UNMOVIC to be provocative in Iraq in the inspections process, in the hopes of getting Iraq to maybe block the inspections, giving the U.S. an opportunity and a motive to invade Iraq.
No, this was
Am I being accurate?
A feeling that I had. I'm not asserting that was the case. It was given to us, and we didn't discuss that. I mean, I didn't voice my doubts, but we had our plans how to go about it, and we wanted to go to sites. Now, the other conclusion I draw, I forgot a moment ago, from this was that if they tell us that go and look into the registers of the ministries, well, it seemed to indicate that they didn't know themselves where they were. I mean, we could also understand that if there are weapons, there will be someone who knows where it is. But it seemed that the U.S. didn't know. And yet they were asserting that, yes, they knew. And indeed, in the longer term, of course, they came with lots of sites that had been given to them, I think, mainly by defectors, but in some cases also through the observation by satellite images.
My guest is Hans Blix, the former U.N. chief weapons inspector in Iraq. His new memoir is called Disarming Iraq. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Hans Blix is my guest, and he was the head of UNMOVIC, the UN Weapons Inspection Team in Iraq. He's written a new book called Disarming Iraq. I'd like to know if you think we are any safer from terrorism after having invaded Iraq, and also how you think the bombings in Madrid figure into that answer.
Well, I would agree with those who say that terrorism there's absolutely no excuse for. Groups attacking people who have nothing to do with the conflict, and that you must have a firm hand. You cannot negotiate with terrorists, small minorities who have the most obscure or peculiar demands. You asked me if I thought that the world had been any safer for terrorism, and I think what we have seen in Iraq in particular, and also in Spain, of course, but Iraq in particular, that has not been safer. Now, that's at the current time. At some point, let's hope that this peters out. But I think the war has bred a lot of hatred in the Middle East, and I've met friends who tell me that it's very different now from before. They feel like humiliated by it, and I think the U.S. or leading people administration here appear to think that the U.N. Security Council was not really relevant. It didn't matter whether they had the approval of the council or not. I think in retrospect, one finds that it had. Meant a lot for the legitimacy, the view of the whole operation. Now, the council refused to give its authorization. There were 11 states in the council that were not willing to vote for the resolution that was accordingly not submitted to the vote. So, yes, I think that the way in which it was done had a clear impact upon the countries and the people, and it promoted, well, that's a harsh word, but at any rate, it facilitated. It gave reasons for people to do terrorist deeds.
We live in a very complicated, confusing world. What do you make of the news that A.Q. Khan, the leading Pakistani nuclear scientist, sold more than $100 million in nuclear technology to Libya and possibly sold nuclear technology to Iran and North Korea? Given that Pakistan is one of the United States' allies in the war on terrorism.
Well, you know, in many countries you do not have complete control of all the secrets. That's happened in the United States too. You had people who were sentenced here to death for passing nuclear secrets to Russia in the past. So no one has complete control. In the Iraqi nuclear, the centrifuges for enrichment were by design that they had got from German engineers who were acting against the law. And, of course, you cannot criticize Germany for it, but there were individuals who did so. In the case of Pakistan, the question I would ask myself, of course, is how alone was Khan? He must have had some associates in the nuclear sphere who participated in this, but did the military government or the army, did they know what was going on? I mean, one would think it's quite plausible at any rate that they knew it. Whether Musharraf knew it, that I have no idea. But he could not have been completely alone in it.
What are some of the lessons you feel you learned in Iraq that should be applied to weapons inspection in Iran if Iran does allow weapons inspectors in?
Well, I think the Iraqi affair has highlighted the usefulness and also to the limitations of inspections. Inspection is powerful, but the countries are big. And if you have a totalitarian country where you cannot move around, then you may not, espionage, satellite things may not help you completely. The combination of intelligence with inspection is very good and it's fairly strong. And I think that in containment, that's it, holding back a development that you do not wish to happen, is the sign of the patient international community. And we shy away. We do not wish to have war. That war is the thing of last resort. But what we saw, and the first Gulf War, of course, was an aggression. So you couldn't do anything but respond by force. But what we saw in the spring here in 2003, I think, was not use of armed force in the last resort. It was alleged to be that, but it wasn't. They could, if they had planned a little differently, they wouldn't have had more than 50,000 men in the field in February, and they could have allowed inspections to go on into the spring and into the summer. And if it didn't work, if you had denial of access, maybe you could also have gone in with armed force in the fall of 2003. So I think they went for the policy of counter-proliferation instead of the containment, which had been the previous one. A new policy of impatience rather than the policy of patience. And I think what you see now in Iran is, for the time being at any rate, a policy of patience. Not one without some threatening gestures, and I think that's right, as in the case of Iraq, you need some demonstration of pressure that something will happen if they are not cooperative. And I hope that this will work. The best would be that the Iranians voluntarily renounce enrichment, and that the Europeans and others will give them assurance that they will get the enriched uranium they need for the power reactors, which is at a much lower level of enrichment than for bombs.
You are the head of a new group, the International Commission on Weapons of Mass Destruction. What is the purpose of this new group, and what role might it play in Iran and North Korea?
Well, from time to time, we need such international commissions. You had the Brundtland Commission, and you had in the nuclear field, most lately, the Canberra Commission. They came up with a number of interesting proposals where one could go. So it's not that we will repeat what will happen, the area they went over, but the reality has changed. We have had the Iraqi case, we now have the North Korean and the Iranian case, and we're, of course, looking not only at nuclear, but also the other weapons of mass destruction, and we will also try to look at the possible link between terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. And by the end of 2005, we should have a report in which this international group will come with suggestions.
You're 75, and you were brought out of retirement to head UNMOVIC, and now you're heading a new agency. Why have you decided to do that instead of going back into retirement?
Well, I think I've been privileged all my life in dealing with things that have interested me. I'm an international lawyer, and I believe very much in that the integration, the growing integration of the international community, which we cannot prevent even if we'd want to do it, that goes on, and that requires regulation. The closer we are to each other, the more regulation you need. And you need some architects, you need some technicians who have some idea of not only the direction or the compass points to, but also something about the map in the terrain in which you move. And I've enjoyed that and continuing to enjoy it. And why should I go back home and just twiddle my thumbs?
Hans Blix, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Hans Blix has written a new memoir called Disarming Iraq. Since the Janet Jackson Super Bowl flap, it seems like everybody is up in arms about indecency on broadcast TV and radio. Clear Channel dropped the Howard Stern Show from its stations, and CBS just announced that they would be putting next month's NCAA Final Four basketball tournament on a 10-second delay. As our linguist Jeff Nunberg observes, this is all part of a conversation that goes back to Shakespeare's time.
A lot of people were dismayed when the FCC refused to sanction NBC last year after Bono uttered the F-word on the Golden Globe broadcast, saying, "This is really, really effing brilliant." But as the agency noted, their guidelines limit indecency to descriptions or depictions of sexual or excretory organs or activities. Whereas Bono merely used the word as an adjective or expletive to emphasize an exclamation, as the agency put it. Actually, some people suggested that the F word is really an adverb when it modifies the adjective brilliant, but I could go either way on that one. I mean, if it were really an adverb, wouldn't it end in L-Y? In the wake of the flap over Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction at the Super Bowl, FCC Commissioner Michael Powell announced that he would be reconsidering the Bono ruling. And a California Republican congressman named Doug Ose recently introduced the Clean Airwaves Act to close what he described as a loophole in the legal definition of indecency. The act explicitly lists seven words that will qualify a broadcast as indecent, however they're used, including verb, adjective, gerund, participle, and infinitive forms. Ose's bill is easy picking for satirists, of course. It's a law that would make it a punishable offense to read its own text over the airwaves. But you have to admit that the FCC was being a little obtuse when it held that Bono's remark wasn't profane. Who's kidding whom here? Does anybody really think that the F word is less of a profanity when it's an intensifier modifying brilliant than when it's describing sexual activity? The fact is that profanity isn't a question of subject matter. It works by a kind of contagious magic. The reference pollutes the word, and then the word profanes everything else it comes in contact with, even if it has nothing to do with the original meaning. That's a principle that children already know when they take a naughty pleasure in pronouncing the word shampoo. And that's why our sense of propriety can be satisfied by the simple expedient of bleeping out part of the word or substituting an asterisk for its vowel. Swear words are like magic spells. They lose their power if every syllable isn't enunciated just so. In fact, profanity is our first lesson in linguistic transgression, even before we understand what it means to lie. That's why it's always a little weird to hear foreigners cursing in English, even if they speak the language fluently. You know that nobody ever washed their mouth with soap for saying them. So the prudes and the profaners are locked into an internal codependence. Swearing has always flourished most luxuriantly in ages when it could count on offending middle-class delicacy. In Henry IV, Part 1, Hotspur rebukes his wife for using the dainty shopkeeper's oath in sooth. Swear me, Kate, like a lady as thou art, a good mouth-filling oath. And say what you will about Ose's bill, at least he and his colleagues are doing their part to keep some of the magic of swearing alive. When you turn to one of the subscription channels and hear a profanity-laced monologue by Margaret Cho, Bill Maher, or Chris Rock, half the pleasure comes from imagining how apoplectic some people would get if they heard that language on NBC or CBS. It gives you the sense you're getting something for your $59 a month. And we all have a stake in keeping those inhibitions alive. Every time we tell our children not to use the F word, we're making a little investment in the future health of profanity. If we ever reach the point where every local TV weatherman is using the word, it won't mean any more for us than darn does. Still, while the family values crowd have already had their effects on programming, they're ultimately fighting a losing battle. The problem isn't that they're being obvious hypocrites. Of course they are, but then where would profanity be without hypocrisy? What does a swear word come down to in the end, if not something you can say in private but not in public? But the boundaries have gotten pretty arbitrary nowadays. Time was that the disapproval of public profanity reflected a basic line of demarcation in American life between the parlor and the rooms in the back of the house. Now it's just a tick mark on the double digits of the dial. Not much of a frontier, particularly when 90% of Americans pay for some form of subscription TV. And it's hard to imagine what Henry James would have made of a world where you can use the F word in the New Yorker, but not the New York Times. Not that the Times is wrong to abjure profanity. It's of a piece with the Edwardian habit of referring to everybody as Mr., even Sting and Moby. But whom exactly are we pretending to protect from what? And when you listen to the run of broadcast fare, it's clear these linguistic scruples don't have much to do with stemming the tide of vulgarity and coarseness. Nowadays, questions of public morality usually come down to purely symbolic gestures. The lesson of the Super Bowl brouhaha was that images of crotch-biting dogs and farting horses are less of a threat to the moral health of the republic than a glimpse of nipple jewelry. We've gotten to the point where somebody can offer a Clean Airwaves Act that consists of a single paragraph containing a list of 7 words. Actually, that's the one thing that makes me wonder if we've let things go too far. Just 7 words, Falstaff wouldn't have known where to start.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and author of the forthcoming book, Going Nuclear. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward remembers the girl group label Dimension Records. This is Fresh Air. Late last year, Sundazed Records reissued a classic American pop album, Dimension Dolls. It was dedicated to the female singers of Dimension Records, complete with 8 bonus tracks from this classic girl group label of the early 60s. Rock historian Ed Ward was delighted.
I hear the neon lights are bright up.
Remember the name Don Kirshner. It may be through his TV show Rock Concert, or because he was the brains behind the Archies. But even before that, in the early 60s, his partnership with Al Nevins and Al Don Music saw him in charge of a stable of songwriters who wrote hit after hit. Neil Sedaka, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, Howie Greenfield, and, most spectacularly, Jerry Goffin and Carole King. These writers would come to work, sit at the piano, and eventually come up with something. If Kirshner liked it, there was a small studio where they'd cut a demo. Then an acetate disc would be made, and the song was ready to be sent to artists in need of material. Al Don's demos, though, were legendary. Jerry Goffin often produced them, and one day Kirshner decided to spend a little more on the demos and put them out. And thus Dimension Records was born.
Up on the roof. When this old world starts getting me down, and people are just too much for me to fail. Up on the roof, I climb way up to the top of the stairs, and all my cares just drift right into space.
Up on the roof,
all the roof is peaceful as can be.
Goffin and King were in their early 20s, married to each other, and almost obscenely talented. It was mostly to showcase their writing and production talents that Dimension was formed, and the singers who recorded for it were from the same pool that made the demos. To demo a girl group record, there was the Cookies, Earl Jean McCrae, Dorothy Jones, and Margaret Ross.
We broke his heart and made him cry, and he's been blue since then. Now he's found somebody new, and you want him back again.
Foolish little girl, fickle little girl, didn't want him when he wanted you. He's found another love, it's her he's dreaming of, and there's not a single thing that you can do.
But I love
solo demos were often handled by Eva Boyd, Little Eva, who sometimes babysat for Goffin and King, and who surprised everybody around Al Don by having a number one hit with her first record.
Everybody's doing a brand new dance now.
Come on, baby, do the locomotion.
I know you get to like it if you give it a chance now.
Come on, baby, do the locomotion.
My little baby sister can do it with me. It's easier than learning your ABC. So come on, come on, do the locomotion with me. You gotta.
The other solo demo singer was Carole King herself.
Mama doesn't like him 'cause he never cuts his hair. Daddy doesn't like him 'cause he says he heard him swear. He's a bad boy. But I don't care. He's not happy working. He's got no use for school. Never.
What set Goffin and King's output apart from earlier Tin Pan Alley hacks was its lyrical and harmonic sophistication. Can you imagine the Beatles recording this?
I'll never let you see the way my broken heart is hurting me. I've got my pride and I know how to hide all my sorrow and pain. I'll do my crying in the rain.
So it's no surprise that when the Beatles came to New York in 1964, Lennon and McCartney said they just hoped they'd someday be capable of writing songs as well as Goffin and King. After all, they'd already recorded the couple's song Chains after hearing the Cookies version. But the Beatles changed the American pop public's taste too, and soon Dimension Records was no more. Goffin and King got amicably divorced and kept on writing together. Don Kirshner looked for other things to do, and Little Eva was a fixture on the oldie circuit until her death in 2003.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He reviewed Dimension Dolls, reissued last year by Sundazed Records. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Atlantic Monthly, presenting modern-day dilemmas around designer children, bionic athletes, and genetic engineering. On newsstands now or at theatlantic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Here comes the moon.
George Harrison was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this week. His recordings on his Dark Horse record label have been re-released in a new box set. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with his widow, Olivia Harrison. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Impulse always quick.